Welcome to A Cult of Personality podcast. I'm honored to welcome to the program Michael Tesarian. You may know him from his many appearances on Red Ice Creations Radio every third Thursday. His website is available at www.michaeltesarian.com. He's the author of the excellent Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation book, as well as the upcoming Irish Origins of Civilization. He's also created an unbelievable DVD series entitled Origins and Oracles. And the truth is, I could go on and on, but he really needs absolutely no introduction. Michael, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be on, and thanks for that nice introduction. Really appreciate it.
No, it's my pleasure, for sure. I appreciate your time. Today, we're going to talk a bit about sort of the Western magical tradition and the divination arts a bit. And I sort of wanted to try to continue, you know, maybe where you had sort of left off with the conversation you had a few weeks ago with Henrik on this subject. And to start off, you know, what you had mentioned, you know, in regards to the origins of these things, of course, sort of goes along with the whole, you know, origins of civilization itself. Is that right?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, how can you have civilization, you know, at all, unless you have sane people, rational people, people who are interested in not only their own lives, but the cosmos about them and all the various mysteries. You know, and then in any age, those people are a minority. I mean, you know, maybe we have some fanciful idea that in ancient times everybody was walking around, you know, semi-enlightened. Of course, we know that that's not true. It's always been a few shamans, a few priests, and even within priestarchies, it's been, again, a very few. Within any society, it'll only be a very, very small minority. And then even a smaller minority of that group who actually has any kind of real understanding of the truth, because, again, just because you have an interest in it doesn't mean you've got, you know, anything that would amount to rational knowledge. I mean, we know many philosophers, even in the Greek period, you know, their philosophy is basically nonsense, it's junk, even though they were a step ahead of everyone else because at least they were asking the right questions. Mm. So, you know, people have to really understand that what the divination arts are all about. They were created by people who had a very, very clear and true understanding of the world in which they lived. They've made a meticulous study of the world and of the universe and of the mysteries of being, and then they tried to preserve it in those arts so that others, should they be, you know, responsible enough and maybe pure enough, they could also use those arts. And so if the arts are put together, even in today's world, in the right way, and you know what you're doing, you know, they still serve the same purpose. And I believe they're fundamental to civilization, absolutely fundamental, because they not only help cleanse the psyche of man so that he is able to see the world clearly, but they also are encoded with, you know, the mysteries of the past that the previous creators or masters have put into those. So every society that uses these divination arts, whether it's the Italians with their tarot, you see, or the Chinese with their astrology, you know, wherever these are found, they are, have a very positive effect, you know. It's only been since in post-Christian times that they've got a bad rap, and anyone, you know, associated with them has been called evil and all of that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point. So, you know, when we talk about sort of the origins of these things, you're talking the pre-Diluvian civilizations, where all of these things came from. I guess I'm very curious as to, you know, why it is that you know, it seems like such a controversy over the origins of these things, and yet, you know, based on your work as well as, you know, so many others, that, you know, it's not really all of that much of a question.
Well, you know, wherever there's there's been also people who don't want you to find out the truth of all of this stuff. So, you know, you're going to have questions. You know, these things are not loved in the same way that they were loved. They're no longer respected, and there's a lot of disinformation about them out there, tremendous amount. And there are also practitioners who don't, you know, who realize it's their power, but maybe they want to use those for very, very mundane purposes. And I'm not that interested in, you know, the beauty of it. I mean, you can be into something, but you may not, you know, care that much about the esoteric sort of background or the wider mysteries of these things, you know. Mm-hmm. Most of the people who use the tarot know it as a game, you know, or say, okay, I'll go and get readings. Yeah, that's one permutation, but my goodness, you know, that's not the end of the tarot or of astrology. That's only one application. So when people, you know, bash it because, oh, well, I got readings that didn't work, or I don't believe in prophecy, you know, right away, you're only bashing, you may even be right, but the fact of the matter is you're addressing one area, one small area of that particular discipline. But people who are intelligent know that, you know, those things can be studied in hundreds of other ways. There's connections between the 78 cards of the tarot, you know, and even the periodic table of elements. You know, the scientists working on that right now. Mm-hmm. So there's all sorts of permutations, not just the one that is most commonly understood, because it's, you know, obvious in people's, in the world in which they live. But, you know, they are pre-diluvian. If people, when the book comes out on Irish Origins, I have a small section on that. I think it's near the beginning of the Irish Origins book in which, you know, I mean, it's obvious that if the Celtic, and I say Celtic, I really mean Irish Druidic, if those people are occupying Ireland and in their own writings and in the histories of the earliest inhabitants of Ireland are saying that these proto-Irish came with four treasures, and that those treasures just happen to be exactly the suits of the tarot, the wand, the sword, the cup, and the disc. You know, we're talking already 5,000 years B.C., and then those same people saying that we came from destroyed islands, great continents that were sank beneath the waves. There you have it, in a nutshell, because the hundreds of symbols that possibly could have been used or possibly could have been brought by the Irish, how come it just happens to be, you know, the symbols for the four suits of this tarot? So when somebody tomorrow wants to go, oh, no, it's Egyptian, it's Italian, it's Chinese, you know, the Irish is the oldest culture in the world. The records of the Irish are the oldest there is, and there you find them. So it's a no-brainer. It's absolutely a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. And since if you people believe what I'm saying, that it's these Irish Druid Magi who ended up moving over to Egypt, well, there's your connection right there. And I don't know how difficult it is to understand that, you know, there could have been movement from the west to the east when infinitely more preposterous things are understood. The world still, even with all the Discovery Channel, PBS programs, man still hasn't got his mind wrapped around the idea that, you know, America might have been discovered before Columbus. They're still humming and hawing about that as if it's some sort of mystery or something. You know, when it's bloody obvious.
Indeed. Right? That's right. Right.
And this has even been treated in movies. It's been treated in even, you know, two-hour length mainstream documentaries. And still people will argue the point, and they're still learning the same old rubbish in schools.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. And I can tell you, just from walking around these, you know, what they called quote-unquote pre-Columbian ruins myself, mm-hmm. and seeing the stones, you know, they're massive, and they're put together in such a way that, you know, it's obvious that the people that did it had, you know, a very advanced knowledge of astronomy and the sun and the constellations and the seasons. It's, you know, it's just overwhelming.
Henrik was showing me, you know, not too long ago, G. Edward Griffin has made a video called The Discovery of the Maya or something. It's a DVD released by G. Edward Griffin about the Ark of the Covenant. That's it. And during Edward's discoveries, investigations in the East, they found these, what later became understood as anchors, big stone anchors that were buried in the ground, and they are then dug up. And everyone can see these are anchors of ships. Mm. Anchors of ships? Have you seen the pictures of this thing? It's like about maybe 10 times the size of a normal metal, big iron anchors that people are familiar with, you know, from the time of the Spanish Armada, and we were amazed at the size of those anchors. These things were about 10 times as large, and they were made out of stone. What kind of ships, you know, did these were anchors for? You know, I mean, you'd think some abstract artist in prehistoric times had had, a whimsy to carve these gigantic anchors, only that's not what they were for. These were legitimate anchors. Well, for what kind of ships? They must have been massive.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we've been told incredible lies. But you see, it's all right to accept. that Marco Polo, you know, crosses the Silk Roads to go into Africa. It's completely acceptable to understand all of those kinds of migrations that center things in the East. It's okay to accept that, you know, that Buddhism was Indian, but it got to China by way of India. That, nobody even bats an eye at a statement like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment you say that people from the British Isles just happened to cross the old land bridge, which is now known to have existed between Britain and Norway, Britain and Scandinavia, and may have, you know, meandered down into Greece and formed the first Grecian suddenly the whole academic world is up against you, saying utter nonsense, even when the land bridge has been discovered. The top geologists in Sweden and Norway have located it, found it, discovered it, proved it. We know that the, you know, enormous shifts in the weather forced people out of Britain and Ireland and the northern countries, and they forced them to move into the south. And, you know, why are we not being taught any of this in school? And the divination arts came with these people. They were part of the treasures that empowered and were brought with these Nordic, Scandinavian, and Irish and people of the old Hyperborean race, or as Professor Tolkien insinuated in his Lord of the Rings, the Numenorean race. Well, these were ancient races that seeded and founded and acculturized and civilized the rest of the races of the world. And I do not find that preposterous.
No, neither do
I. What I find preposterous, and I'm sure you do too, and many of your listeners, is that the same authorities who tell us not to believe that turn around and tell us that history is only 7,000 to 11,000 years old. It all happened in the Middle East in the deserts where there's not a trace of any civilization of any standing. And that it all moved east to civilize the East, and it only happened about 10,000 years ago. That's what I find utterly preposterous.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And even though Michael Cremo and, you know, others like Gerald Hancock and so many other, Graham Hancock and so many others, have basically shot that down, even with photographic evidence, you know, what is the mass of the world still believing? When are we going to realize that we need a thorough reexamination of all the lies? You know, every week somebody's sending me some new discovery, you know, on email, you know, say, hey, Michael, you might like this. We found this out. You know, we've got Caucasian mummies down there in New Zealand where the Maori have been saying, even to the experts, no, do not consider us the proto-inhabitants of New Zealand. Please don't say that because our tradition, we don't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But the academics go on and say, no, you were the original people there. Native American Indians go, no, we're not the original ones. The blonde ones from the area of the rising sun, the Arya, they're first.
Mm-hmm.
So how come that's all been suppressed? How come we don't know that? And then how come words like word Aryan have been so, you know, manipulated and lambasted so that we have a completely false understanding? Who might have wanted to do that? Who might have wanted to take a fantastic word that gives so much insight into the world that's found in every corner of the globe? And damage that word to such an extent that you're basically going to lose your career, your job, and your standing if you even too much as mention it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they want to manipulate a lot of things that we think, for sure. But
they don't mind it if you go and talk about African origins of civilization or, you know, Chinese origins of civilization. If you're saying that, you know, Eastern individuals initiated it, that they're perfectly happy to accept.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you say, no, it's Western, then you got a problem. This is what I can't stand, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's hypocrisy.
Well, you're certainly, you know, doing a lot to reverse that, in my opinion, anyway.
Well, that's I'm very motivated to do that because I've had enough of these lies. I follow the truth no matter where that truth should lead. And I put the pieces together as they are being put together, and I'm not denying that there were later migrations in the AD period, starting about 600 AD, leading up to 700 BC and leading up to 600 AD. Yes, there was migrations. Yes, there was the Mycenaean drought. Yes, there was the Great Thera volcano, which pushed people out of the east. You know, yes, there may have been the Israelites, although we could totally reconstruct what the word Israelite means, but we probably don't have the time to do that. But certainly, even if you want to go with that traditional theory, I can accept that, you know, Eastern people from the Middle East, from Levant, were pushed westward. There's nobody doubting that. And there's no doubt that they brought a lot of cultural symbols with them. But the fact remains, were those cultural symbols their own to begin with? Or did they inherit them from somewhere else? You see, now that people like Ralph Ellis and Mustafa Gadala and Abdul Osman have proven that the so-called Israelites are in fact a pharaonic dynasty from Egypt, doesn't that call for the review of everything that's in the Bible, that everything that Jews and Christians believe?
Oh, no.
In my opinion, actually, it shoots cannonballs through what they believe. But, you know, even if we leave that aside, at least we should, you know, maybe settle on a review of what's been, you know, said, but you're never going to hear that. You're never going to hear our work being treated, you know, in any kind of way.
No.
By the mainstream, and that's perfectly all right.
It's too dangerous in that respect, but that's a great point you make in regards to, you know, the Israelites and, you know, the work, you know, showing them to be, you know, a pharaonic dynasty.
Yeah.
And what I think is even more interesting is if you look at the Kabbalah, right, and if we're talking about it coming from the West, then that seems to me a very clear indication, because the Kabbalah is clearly uses the Hebrew language. It's integral to how it works.
Well, when you say Hebrew, you know, that's already, we have to interpret what that really means, because it's not the meaning of the word.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
That we have been told, you know, again, it's a bit of a long story to go into the etymology, but people can visit my website, my work, and they can look into the meaning of the word Hebrew in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
One translation of it is it means man of the river.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that does mean the Nile, the man of the famous river of the Nile. But it doesn't distinguish a race. It distinguishes elders, people who were initiated into the mysteries. And those elders did exist amongst Jews. They did amongst Egyptians. It's not a racial title. They could have, you know, they could have existed amongst, you know, the Aztecs for all any of the ancient people were concerned.
Exactly.
You know, when you were an elder, in the same way that in Masonry today, which is ostensibly a carry-on of these traditions, the idea is that your race doesn't matter when you come into the lodge. It's your initiated level. Well, it's no different in the mystery schools of old. But when you realize that it's the Hebrew or the Hebrew, the man of fire or the man of the river, all the different interpretations, all the meanings of the word, that these people obviously taught this mystery tradition. They took it to colleges far and wide. They had a mystery school tradition of which Pythagoras and so many other people were involved. And when Christianity came along, all of these libraries, not just the famous one at Alexandria, were burned to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
There was dozens of them. Dozens of them. And a lot of them were on the 42nd and the 45th meridian of the earth. They're all vanished now. They were all burned down and the knowledge was appropriated. The people who are in control and in power today have those books. They weren't burned, they were taken.
Mm-hmm.
They were taken and put into, you know, the Vatican Library and other places, which is a whole study, which has come to light. And there's many other secret private libraries all around the world that contains the ancient scrolls of these ancient, you know, Egyptian and Alexandrian mystics.
Mm-hmm.
And the same way that the tombs of Egypt were robbed, well, all the way down through the centuries, the reliquaries and the ancient libraries have been robbed and purged, and that is the knowledge base upon which Freemasonry, Illuminism, royal families, royal dynasties, they're privy to it.
Mm-hmm.
They're privy to all that's taught in those things. Same idea when, you know, we hear about Henry VIII going and burning down the monasteries, and we have these images of, oh yeah, he purged the monasteries. Sure, he purged them. After his guys had brought the horses and carts and taken all the books out, then they burned them down. You're meant to think those books, you know, are gone forever. No. Those books later turn up in the library of Sir John Dee, who lived on the River Thames, one of the greatest occultists ever lived, who had the biggest library in history at that time. It was far in excess of the official library in England. John Dee's collection, private collection, you know, was many thousands of books. I believe a lot of them taken from those monasteries during the dissolution time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the queens and kings have access to those books, and their children have access to those books, so that they're empowered with occult knowledge while everybody else is running around. Libraries are closing, schools are teaching rubbish. People can't even speak the English language properly anymore. They're not interested in their own cultures anymore. You know, we're in this polyglot, totally diverse, so-called polyglot culture in which nobody knows anything about their own ancestry and their own race, you know,
mm-hmm.
and their own archive of knowledge.
So would it be an accurate thing to say that, you know, the language that's used in Kabbalah and, you know, in all of these things is the key to tracing it, you know, through its origin to its many sort of forms that it's come to?
Yeah, the language is very important. That's a big loophole, you see, because you can't really change that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't change the language of a people so easily. And, of course, if you know what you're looking for and you're a little bit educated into those matters, like through etymology, study of words, study of names, absolutely, you know, the study of old cities. You can't go around and change all the names of cities and roads and districts and territories, you see, so they're going to tell you a big story
mm-hmm.
if you have the eyes to see. And there's no doubt in these mysteries. I mean, look at the word Kabbalah. How can anybody describe that those strange three phonemes, Ka and Ba, stand out like a sore thumb to anyone who's even done 5 minutes of research into Egyptology, because those are the two parts of the Egyptian soul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's two parts of the Hebrew soul. When you know what the Hebrew meant, the Hebrew just meant the wise ones of Egypt, the wise ones of Ireland, the wise ones of Phoenicia, the wise ones of Babylon. Yeah, so the wise ones understood that the Ka, the Ba, and the Allah still creeps through in the, you know, Persian, where we have Allah.
Mm-hmm.
Or El, as the Semites would have called it. But these are three parts of the soul, because the Egyptians had many parts of the soul. We today have many forms of personality. We even talk about people being bipolar or schizophrenic, implying that there's many kinds of personality. And we all know that even one person has a dark side, an angry side, a happy side, you see. We just consider those sides of one personality. Well, the Egyptians didn't. The Egyptians believed that all of those were individual souls. The happy soul, you know, the dark soul, the sort of the semi-criminal soul, the lustful soul, you see, the moral soul. And it's which one of the souls fighting, you know, would get dominance. Which one of those souls would turn into the Ka or the Ba?
Mm.
Would be more, you know, rarefied. We see the same concept turning up in the Jungian idea, that you have four parts of the soul, or Freud's aspect of where the ego is divided, or consciousness, sorry, is divided into three parts. You know, so the language may change, the schemata may change, you know, sort of become scientific, but it's an old story of the soul, and it's only Christians who, you know, tend to look at the soul as a unitary thing, even though they still concede that there's a tripartite, you know, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost concept going on.
Mm-hmm.
All borrowed from the ancient peoples.
Mm-hmm.
So, immediately looking at the word, you know, merely looking at the fact that for time immemorial, the Kabbalah has been described as a tree. I'll tell you, that always jumped out at me. Mm-hmm. If you're from Ireland and you're grown up with Druidic tradition, I don't care about anywhere else you come from, but the very moment that you read about the Kabbalah being a tree whose roots are 22 roots are in the earth and 22 branches reaching up. You're immediately thinking of the Norse legends of the Yggdrasil, right? The world ash tree.
Mm.
You're instantly thinking of Odin hanging on the great tree of the runes. You've just moved westward in your consciousness in 10 seconds flat. You're just thinking, oh my God, the Druids and their 13 calendars based on the tree. You don't need to be the great Robert Graves to know that the Druids were obsessed by the tree and the 13 sacred trees. The very moment that you hear about burning bush, a burning tree, that God is behind the tree, you immediately know, if you've done any research, what the significance is, that there's Druidic symbolism involved here.
Or that the Buddha, you know, achieved enlightenment beneath the tree.
Yeah, that's right. Because what is Buddha is nothing but your mind, buddhi. The second derivation of the word Buddha is meaning intelligence, Buddha, buddhi, meaning you are intelligent, you are the Buddha. And the Buddha never got tired telling you, you are the Buddha, not me. If you see the Buddha on the road, burn him, you know, it's like, you're it, baby, you're Odin, you are the one who's going to have to hang on the tree, you're the Christ. But the homogenists turn around and go, no, you're the sinner, he's the Christ. They do it all for you, we do it for you, we're the priests, you're the nobody. Turned the whole thing around, and they did it in the East, and they did it in the West. And that's one of the reasons why the world is suffering today. You know, they found evidence, Ralph Ellis especially has discovered that the trees that stood in the most sacred, there's barely any evidence of it anymore. It's very, very scanty evidence. But the evidence that does exist has led people like Ralph Ellis, the scholar and the writer, to discover that the trees that stood, that had been planted in the most sacred of all the Egyptian temples, were Irish yew trees.
Mm.
A particular kind of yew that's not quite like the modern yew, but it's more thin. It's like a cypress tree. But it's a yew tree whose derivations go back to Ireland. It was an Irish tree that was being worshipped in the center of Egyptian mystery schools. If that doesn't talk about the presence of Western men, I don't know what does, and there's plenty of other evidence for that as well.
Yeah.
So we have to get our minds not only around the fact that the divination arts moved from the East, from the West to the East, we've got to get our minds around the Western movement of the elements of civilization, and we've got to get our minds around that Egyptian culture is founded upon Druidic culture. It's just that the words are different, but the symbolism proves it.
That's
tremendous,
right.
Tremendous to study this thing.
Now, is it also correct to say that, you know, the they talk about the twin pillars, right, of the Temple of Solomon being made of these perfected ashlar wood?
That's right. Or any kind of wood, actually. You know, it used to be shown as papyrus plants or as palm trees. In fact, the mystery schools of ancient Egypt used to be called Palmyrians because the symbolism often was the palm tree. And palm fronds, or whatever you would call them, the big leaves of the palm tree, were often put on either side of a sun disk. And when they were put on the other side of the sun disk, even though they were palm fronds, eventually morphed into looking like wings. Mm-hmm. Because the palm frond, you know, if it's put on either side of a sun disk and put above a door or a temple door, it became indistinguishable from the wings of Horus. So people know about the wings in the sun disk, a very famous Egyptian symbol. But an equivalent of that was the palm fronds, you know, of the palm tree. And then you have the date palm, which is also very sacred. Remember Jesus, the fig tree?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I meet you under the fig tree. You know, the incredible symbolism rising out of the Bible, even hinting at the tree. People just read that and go, oh, lovely imagery. Wait a minute. There's a reason why that particular tree is being mentioned, the sycamore tree. What the, you know, thought they were not be into paganism. Well, go to any church and look at the columns, the way they're designed. The Grecian, even the famous Grecian and Roman columns are ribbed like a tree, and the little trefoil symbols at the top mm-hmm. of these Dorian columns and these colonnades, they represent the little motifs representing the trunks of trees, because the tree has so much symbolism involved in it and was sacred to many gods.
Mm. Absolutely.
This thing opens up into, you know, found out that many church, this is actually well known, but many churches are placed in England and Ireland, Scotland and Wales near yew trees. There'll be a yew tree, and then 5 feet away, there'll be, or 10 feet away, there'll be a church. Well, we know that trees are older than churches, so it wasn't that the trees that suddenly decided to spring up near these wonderful Christian churches. No, it's the other way around. Somebody who built Christian churches purposely planted those stones in the proximity of the yew tree, which was one of the most sacred trees to the Druids. Now, who would do that? And if they did do it, as they did, okay, is this Christian or is this pagan? What's going on here? But, you know, how many thousands have gone to these churches without even concerned about it or thinking about where the placement is, what was here on this land before the church got here? What is this site?
Mm-hmm.
The coronation of the Queen of England has taken place in Westminster Abbey. They're going up Pall Mall. They're going into the Buckingham Palace. You know, St. Paul's Cathedral. What stood on those places before?
Exactly.
You know, the incredible shrines to gods of light, gods of the heavens, that people have forgotten about, and yet their symbolism is all in the churches. If you go and look at those churches and really know what you're looking at when you visit these cities, you'd be blown away at the Masonic and Druidic and symbolism. It's all around people in plain sight. Nothing is hidden.
Yeah, you don't have to go to Rosslyn Chapel to see it.
No. You don't, no. That's only one, you know, example, one paltry example. And it's a hodgepodge because, of course, being Templar, it incorporated many traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Herne, you say he's a green man. They appropriated that from the Celts. Well, my God, the Christian church, how many Christian churches do you know that have what are known as the Celtic crosses on them?
Well, I can see one out my window right now.
Right. TNN. Look at the logo for the Trinity Broadcasting Network, right? TBN. It shows you a dove, and it shows you a Celtic sun cross. Now, why would the artist have chosen that out of hundreds of crosses? You know, it's no necessity for a very famous American network to suddenly be using Celtic crosses when there's so many others available. But why did they use that, you see?
Mm-hmm.
They're telling you something. They're telling you something.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, another sort of question I had regarding all of these things, sort of in a later time frame, is it really possible to sort of overestimate the importance of the whole occult resurgence at the beginning of the 20th century with the Golden Dawn and all the people involved with them?
Well, there's obviously two ways of looking at that, because all orders, like all people, are, you know, two-sided.
Mm-hmm.
And it just depends what, you know, perspective you're coming in from, whether you think that these things were a good, you know, thing or bad. I mean, I believe it has a bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't blame some organizations, you know. It's ridiculous in a way, you know, to blame a school. It's the people in it.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's often the people who have taken it over, like in the case of Theosophy. You know,
mm-hmm.
5 minutes of research, we've got articles on the blog, on the forum. Red Ice has carried some stuff, you know, on the fact that of the takeover. And I addressed it in one of my presentations about the, although it was very briefly, talked about the taking over of Theosophy by the Fabians and by this Alice Bailey creature and her
right.
husband and their coterie, you see.
Nanny
completely
Besson.
Different. Ooh, yeah. Completely different creatures than Blavatsky. Blavatsky would have turned in her grave if she thought the politics came anywhere near occultism. That was her worst taboo. You know, absolutely no way. When you joined her order, you left all that crap at the door. and you came in to think about perfection of the self, a spiritual, mystical, private thing. You didn't take it out into the streets to influence politics, but these people who joined later on were obviously, you know, subverters. Well, it's the same thing in the Order of the Golden Dawn. The leader of that was, you know, obviously the brains behind it. They had three leaders, Wynne Westcott and Mathers. But Mathers was a student, a scholar, an Egyptologist. A guy just wanted to sit in the library, you know, as he did for 35 years studying the mysteries.
Right.
He wasn't interested in politics. In fact, if anybody in his family was interested in politics, it was his wife, Monia, who was a, you know, famous, you know, loudmouth, you know, Irish Republican, you know, revolutionary type, who in the normal political way went around screaming about Irish reform. You know, but her husband was this guy lost in the past, interested in divination, you know, and that's his perfect choice.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want the studies that of the Golden Dawn, you know, taken out and into the public eye either. He believed that people should be purified when they came in. They should be reverent and they should study it, but, you know, or they could leave it as the case may be. But what, you know, there's now there's 101 Golden Dawns running around. It's just like, you know, any of these orders.
Mm-hmm.
And what we really have to maintain an understanding of, especially if we're studying anything like the OTO or the Masons, very, very important to understand that we're not implicating ordinary Masons who join from the street level or any of these, you know, orders themselves, because they're divided. They have an inner lodge and an outer lodge. And people really need to understand this, that the public figure may be heading an outer lodge, which is mostly exoteric.
Mm-hmm.
And may not even have a clue what the inner lodge version is doing.
That's right.
It's just the same way with the Rosicrucians, you know, and the Masons and all these other occult orders.
Every society I've ever encountered works that way.
Doesn't university work like that, where you've got some fraternities where they'll kick your ass if you come around there and ask them about their, you know, they don't even allow cameras in to this day.
That's right.
So, you know, we don't need to be worrying about, you know, these kinds of things. We need to be worrying about the, you know, Opus Dei, the Jesuit order, the skull and bones. We got enough on our plate to worry about than sort of musing over what Blavatsky may have been doing, you know, was she talking to the devil or something, you know. Look, you know, that's slightly less important than what's going on, you know. And then, and even if you would want to spend your time really researching it, then read her own works and find that this incredible woman was begging the world to watch out for sorcery, for that the world is wall-to-wall with sorcery, that there are no magicians left, there is no people practicing the spiritual art. Everyone's into it looking for power and control over other human beings. Read her own words and then come out and say, was this person the same creature as Alice Bailey, who's talking about, you know, the hidden elect and how mankind must be guided because they're all so dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different kind of tone, completely different kind of terminology, completely different kind of intention.
Right.
You take the golden works of somebody, a great man create, or a great woman creates an order. Do you know how many of those have been sabotaged and subverted down through time? The list is endless. Well, of the works of a great man being then taken, you know, and used, abused. There's even modern examples of this. Don't we know that songs of great musicians are ripped off, that everybody's copying, you know, a great genius? Jesus, if you didn't have Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan, you know, I mean, who would you have, you know, playing the acoustic guitar today? You know, how many people owe, you know, to a handful of great musicians their so-called style?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's unbelievable when you think about it. So, you know, that's one interesting area of research, but what we've really got to understand is that these groups are in your face today in more of a blatant way than can ever be imagined. And that we need to track these things today and find out whether or not the criminality of these organizations has stopped, or is it perpetuating, is it continuing? And whistleblowing movies like the James Bond series and other movies that have come out, like V for Vendetta and so many others, are trying to tell you, you know, to the cost of millions of dollars, some very incredible story. But what humankind must realize is that's just not fiction. Don't just be accepting that as fiction. Fiction just happens to be one of the ways, one of the best ways, to get the message out to a wider group of the people than, say, a book would. Because people don't read anymore.
That's a great point.
Yeah. Well, look, what's his name? Michael Moore, you hate him or you don't, it doesn't matter, but his book, just as one example, Angry White Men or whatever it was called, that was on the, I think it was on the, if I'm not mistaken, that was actually on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah,
and yet even being, what, it was?
It was, yeah.
Right. So now look, that is prestigious. And he also had his fame. He had his notoriety because he had done several movies already. So even with all that exposure, even with everybody knowing he's a good laugh, at the very least, and everybody knowing that he's got a book on the bestseller list, only 1 million people, barely 1 million people in America read that book. But a movie goes out to 30 million or more. Now, that's his book with all his notoriety. Imagine if you're Eustace Mullins or G. Edward Griffin or, you know, Dan Smoot or whoever, you know, or, you know, whoever. How many people are going to read that? You're down into the thousands, you see.
Yeah.
So now with the internet and with, you know, a movie, it's so much larger, you know, to get the word out. And that's why some movies have gone that far, and they will take that opportunity to try and do that. Or they'll try to make a subtextual comment about things. And that, all of that is very good. It all adds up in the long run to get the word out to millions of people that maybe not have heard of it before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think recently, I don't know if you saw, The Good Shepherd kind of did that.
We've downloaded it, but I haven't really looked at it yet. It was a plan for the next couple of days because I've had so many emails from people and also forum comments telling me to watch that, you know, so I definitely will get around to it. Very eager to watch that, you know, but saw some other very good films. You know, it's always good to see good movies out there, both old and new, that are addressing this, you know, the problem, not only the problems of politics, but the problems of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, that consciousness is, because we have a tidal wave of negative media, you know, with all these ugly, rotten videos that are being produced with so much necrophiliac and satanic symbolism, with so many commercials, you know, just dumbing down people and basically psychically attacking people. You know, we've got a barrage of negative stuff there. People who know how to manipulate symbols to drag the soul down.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very nice to see, you know, other types of movies that have a different kind of an agenda. You know, and even though they may be countercultural movies and people may not really gel with the imagery and whatever, let's look at the message and say, okay, you know, we need that too, because we've got a crisis here. We've got people who need to become very symbol literate, and we need to sort of become aware of all of these forms of psychic tyranny that are happening in the world, because it's getting more and more and more.
Absolutely is, yeah.
The latest shooting, the latest killing, and the arrival of the royal family, you know, on the Feast of Beltane, which of course is in the regular calendar, May 1st, yes, but the stars have moved in many thousands of years, so Beltane actually falls on May 5th, and the 3 days around that, so May 6th, May 7th. So how come it happens that the royals know that, but everybody else doesn't know that? Because the calendar says May 1st is Beltane, but they know that the stars is where you go by. You go by the stellar zodiac, and therefore it's a few days off.
Mm.
And so they worship their birthdays, they do all of these visitations, and they do their ceremonies based on the stellar zodiac, not even so much the solar zodiac, and so that people who maybe even be into astrology don't see the patterns. Yeah, because they're into a highly esoteric form of astrology that you're not meant to know anything about.
Exactly.
But when you do find out about it, then you start to see that the 10 days period, you see, or the 30 day period in and around certain, like this whole thing with April and April 19th, April 16th, right up to April 23rd, there are certain patterns that happen on certain, you know, degrees of the zodiac. And you start to find through time that there are these patterns, you know, openings of this, closings of that, you know, assassinations, all sorts of ritualistic goings on,
mm-hmm.
that the media puts in front of you, this random action with no connection. When your eyes are open, you start to say, oh, no, there is a connection. There's some very powerful numerology and geometry involved in here, because the one thing why I work specifically in the divination arts is not because I'm some member of the New Age movement with nothing better to do. It's because I've studied the occult, and I know that the people who are in control of the world today use those very disciplines with less right than the people we're talking to now on this radio show. With less right. Not more right, less right, because they're not moral. They're virtuous people using knowledge and occult knowledge to disempower the world, treating people like a robot, just like, animals. One world, they look at all the people as just one sort of automaton, and they're heading very quickly towards this transhuman world where the man literally will have no human DNA left. They'll condition all of that out. Look at the contempt that these people have, and I'm addressing people here who've read my Atlantis book and know about the transgenic experimentations that happened where the human DNA was crossed with alien DNA. Well, to me it's outrageous that they'll even say junk DNA. They'll even refer to human DNA as junk DNA. Who is saying that? And is that the DNA that's human? Is that what they're referring to? Because what they really want to make us into is, you know, more of a carbon copy of the alien, that they'll even turn around and tell you that your DNA, the most private, intimate, biological aspects of your being, are junk.
Mm.
Yeah. I know what they mean behind that. That's all the human sensibilities and other, you know, other sides of the human genome that have not been tapped into, that are considered now redundant and basically considered disposable. That's the junk DNA, the human side. Tomorrow, when it's a, you know, a technically run DNA, when they finally got the whole silicon organic computer going, then it won't be junk, then it'll be just marvelous. The man is a completely, you know, hybrid automaton cyborg creature with his behavior and his thinking so regimented as to be indistinguishable from a machine. Then they won't be calling that junk. They'll be telling you they've reached, you know, the quintessence, that they've reached the fifth element, that man has become perfected.
Yeah, yeah. You don't have to look very far for people that seem to crave this. You know, they can't get this there fast enough.
That's right. All the corporations, why are they using the pentagram? You know, street layouts, city designs are based on it. There's a whole philosophy. There's a whole technocracy out there. They call it the technocracy of power. Mm-hmm. The technotronic world, as the bigger new Brzezinski's called it. And he's only a gatekeeper for all of these people. He's only a face that you see. But there's an entire cult. They're talking about neocons. You don't even know what's behind them. They're the good. Those guys look good compared to some of the other maniacs that you've got. Their philosophy is so extreme that not even, you know, they can't even be brought in front of the people. People like Lyndon LaRouche, you know, we're called the syndicalists, and other more darker characters deeply into the occult, who've always looked at mankind as being just a robot. And they have a plan to, they've been doing, it's actually the process is not going to begin, it's been going on for thousands of years, of dehumanizing women and dehumanizing men, and causing so much turmoil psychically and psychologically. And they're just too happy to bring in this Malthusian or Orwellian, you know, world, in which you're basically plugged in. And that your drives are completely studied, your libido is totally known, all your desires, wants, and needs provided for by Big Brother, one corporation, you see, where you go straight to one source for everything you need. This technotronic world, they can't wait for it. And it's all born out of this idea that nature is inert, stupid, and dumb, and has no intelligence, so you need to force it. You need to compel man by artificial means and by effort to the next stage, which they describe as Epsilon. Or quintessence, the fifth stage. They have no respect for the fact that, look, when nature wants to get you to that stage, I think it'll handle it. I don't think you need to bother. It's created the air, it's created oxygen, it's created the Amazon rainforest, it's created the oceans. You know, nature helps a plant get from seed, right, to oak tree with no human help. So, believe me, I think nature possibly could handle it without your interference. But no, they believe that, you know, you bring in this silicon hand. It's very connected to what, you know, Drumvalo Melchizedek was talking about, the great silicon eye, that the higher man, the being that they create, has basically the carbon eye and the silicon eye. Mm-hmm. And the invention of the computer and the new silicon technology is a road, a means to an end to that, to awaken man's silicon eye, like the two eyes of Horus or the two eyes of Ra. Mm-hmm. And that man as a carbon entity is not complete. They consider that, you know, a rude, lower Adamic form. And, of course, they would have wanted to do this thousands of years ago, but my work surmises that the technology, you see, was drastically reduced and the plan was delayed. But they, since the Industrial Revolution, they've been, you know, doing well, and they're building their technology back. We're now in an era in which this is, they're hard at it, that MIT, SRI, all Genentech, all of these corporations, just like in some hideous James Bond way, but as crazy as those movies may be, they're also telling you a lot of truth. And there's many other movies besides that talk about this.
Yeah, these places are propagating like mad at this point.
Yeah, probably, yeah. And they're all from a central source. Well, why is the Pentagon that shape? Why didn't they make it a triangle? You know, the Pentagon is for a reason. They're telling you something in the design. These are the pentads. These are the people who know about the five and one. Mm-hmm. And all the symbolisms of, you know, what that represents. Not just connecting to war.
That's right. But
connecting to off-world presences and many other what you call scientific phenomena.
Yeah, people should ask themselves, you know, why these words are connected, you know, Pentagon, penal code, you know, all of these things, they all are related.
Yeah, and there's some very interesting, you know, things to be discovered that way when people look at the history of words, because there's one loophole that they haven't been able to really, you know, completely do away with, even though they've done a pretty good job. We know that many languages, like even the Irish language, have gone through so many incarnations, even down through history, that the Irish Gaelic that may be spoken now is kind of unrelated in many ways to the original form of Gaelic. So, yeah, we know that there's been, you know, can't think of the word, but deconstruction or dissolution of some of the original precepts.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there's enough to go on with. There's still enough to go on with to discover things, and if you delve into it, it's incredible what an archive the names and words really represent. You know, Pentagon, Pentium. You know, I go into that on my DVDs as a sort of a crash course of letting people realize just how incredible these words are. The word Atlantis, for instance, is found all over the world in various forms or another, you see?
Yes, it is indeed.
Lemuria, you know, the motherland, you know. These terms that can be crop up all over the place. And as I said so many times before, you know, we are now in a situation coming down to a sort of a countdown situation in which the world as we know it could terminate within the next 10 years. Not nature, of course, not the world itself, but the world as we know it, the world of human construct, so sociologically, economically, politically, militaristically. That's already in so much transition, I don't know how people could even doubt this fact.
Mm-hmm.
It's already on a way to being revolutionized.
Yeah.
And three great world wars were planned, you know, in the minds of the people who conceived that of the wars that would change mankind. It wasn't two world wars that was conceived, it was three.
Yeah. You know, and this is a great point you bring up, because you've talked about this, and I've looked at this question quite a bit in depth, you know, looking at the work of you and Yuri Lina and some other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just can't escape the fact that, you know, it is this, you know, rather diabolical plan. And, you know, regardless of, you know, how, you know, people want to cover it up, you know, it's still there.
Once the wheels got started, you know, they couldn't stop. It's just like anything. When you find it, you can't stop. And so, therefore, these people have done. They're building a power pyramid. Well, when you build one layer, you got to move to the next. It's an architecture. And it's not been one generation of people who've, you know, created this. It's been many hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done it in every country. And because people are myopic, people are xenophobic, people are insecure, they only know the newspaper tells them on the TV, you know, about their own family or their own lineage and maybe a bit of the history of their country that's been taught to them, you know, in school. They're not ready for it.
No,
so
no.
They think when you're talking about secret societies, you're talking about some sort of, you know, Gambino cult or some sort of Lucky Luciano thing, you know, a bunch of mafia guys have come in and sort of taken over. Like it's, you know, it's like a Elliot Ness and the Untouchables, you know, kind of scenario.
Mm-hmm.
No, no, no. They didn't come in and take over. They built what you're sitting on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, those built beautiful state buildings downtown, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
They created all of that.
But why do you think they called it the Mayflower, right? The ship ship they came over on, right? It's the Mayflower.
Isn't that fantastic?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it really disturbs me, you know, we're doing this talk on the 8th, you know, one day after the Queen of England is standing on the balcony with George Bush waving. And right in front of her is the shield of America.
Mm-hmm.
The president is off to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And the greatest enemy that America has ever known is standing on the balcony, waving to the American people with the American state of, you know, seal in front of her, like it's saying, okay, chumps, who rules you now?
Mm-hmm.
You thought we had lost by force of arms? Hey, what happens if we willfully lost that war? What happens if we sat down one day back there in the time of King George III and worked it out in the 1700s that, yeah, we probably could win if we brought our mercenaries. We could suppress America. But then we would have had the problem, you see, of trying to suppress uprising, which means our entire army would have been in America and Canada with the unenviable task of trying to suppress the inevitable rising of guerrilla warfare, you see, and rebels all over one of the greatest continents in the world. Impossible. I mean, you don't have to be a British military general to know that that's impossible. And then you leave your country open to attack in England because all your army's over in America. So knowing that, what do you think would be the next step?
Mm-hmm.
Is it so far-fetched for us to understand that they willfully lost the war of arms so that America would do exactly as America did, which is believing happily that they had destroyed America, destroyed their enemies, England, would then turn off and become completely, you know, unhistorical. We've dealt with the tyrant. He's been thrown back. We don't need to worry about any foreign enemies anymore. We go to sleep. We get apathetic. We make ourselves millionaires, and we, you know, we lap it up in a new land, and the enemy is still at the door, but we don't know it because they've actually fooled us. They're way ahead of us.
Yeah, that's right.
and you turn away for 5 minutes and you lay down your arms and you get real apathetic, and then in comes the Carnegies, you see, and the Pierponts and the Morgans, you know, and the Lazard brothers and the whole Federal Reserve System, and the list is endless for those who studied it. So, yeah, all of them screaming allegiance to the British Crown, even in their own memoirs and their own writings, Henry Ford and the Kennedys.
Yeah. Well, I
and here we have, what's that? And now we have the full component, now we have the fulfillment of all of that. Not just the Roosevelts and the Trumans, you know. Now, standing on the balcony with the American, you know, coat of arms in front of her is the Queen of England going, hello. And I don't know how many years ago it was, maybe one of your listeners knows, that the Queen of England was actually given the rights to the whole of New York City. It was like back in the 70s, I think, when she made another visit, that she was actually presented with the keys, some major, you know, award, not an award, but a major right over the state of New York City. The mayor of New York offered the Queen of England economic and social rights over New York. I can't remember exactly the details. That's an obscenity.
Well,
it's an obscenity. What happened yesterday is an obscenity.
Yeah, I have heard that she is the largest single real estate owner of so-called U.S. territory or whatever.
That's right. Through the Russell Trust, which is a better word for the people have heard of the Skull and Bones Society.
Mm-hmm.
Skull and Bones Society is nothing but the Russell Trust. And the Russell Trust is part an old hybrid, basically indistinguishable from the Hudson Bay Company, which was the British East India Company. You know, they're just different names, Virginia Company. That's right. There's even parts of the East. I think it was Connecticut or Virginia. There was actually called Windsor. Mm-hmm. They had to take this off after the so-called war. But originally the land was owned by the Windsors and the House of Orange.
Because
remember, the House of Windsor in England originally, not originally, but comes also by way of Holland, the Dutch connection. Well, we know how much the Dutch were involved in the creation of New York, you see, and the setting up of the trade routes and all of that. So we know this. So these people own it. And I think it was Eustace Mullins or somebody said that when the Russell Trust agents go in to visit with the president, no minutes are kept. In complete breach of protocol, every meeting, of course, is kept in minutes. The discussion, who arrived, what time they arrived, and what the basic discussion was about, detailed minutes are meant to be kept for posterity. But you never hear about when the Russell Trust agents, these old opium dealers of old, who subjugated the entire world for mercury and opium, when they come in to meet with the president and tell him, hey, buddy, here's your next set of rules, that's never put down in minutes, you see. So the American people don't know about the secret government. Well, there's a secret government. There's a secret council of MEPs running the European Union. There's the secret group of Opus Dei people behind the neocons. There's a secret group of Russell Trust agents that make periodical visits to the, you know, the president. President is only president of the corporation of the United States. He doesn't own the land. He's only the corporation that stands upon the land. But who owns the land itself?
Mm-hmm.
So the British rule and own the land. So they don't really care what kind of, you know, stuff goes on later on above it. They own it all. And their agents are in the helm of everything. Either their agents or the Vatican agents. It really boils down to the same thing. They're all Atenists.
Yeah.
We don't want to get into that story.
Yeah, well, speaking of agents and this whole story of, you know, I encountered some things, you know, in terms of that, you know, just about around the whole, you know, declaration and all of that, you know, where you had this mystery man who turns out to be most likely Saint Germain, you know, popping in on the signing to make sure that it goes ahead, right?
That's right. Incredible, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When you realize that a lot of this was occult in nature, that even the putting in of certain stones of the monument and the Capitol building and so many other buildings was done precisely on certain astrological times, right down even to the minute, like 3:33, you know, all these Masonic numbers, 3:33 p.m., the stone will be dropped into place. Mm-hmm. Right down to these kinds of things. Right down to the geomancy.
Mm-hmm.
Right down to positioning their buildings on areas which are highly geomantically positive so that they get good energy and good chi, as it's called in the East. We would just call it good energy. And putting all, you know, the ordinary people's houses in areas which is not so great on reclaimed land, which is really toxic, so that those people are always, you know, building in blocks, building, you know, America is famous for its blocks. Well, anybody, you know, who knows anything about true geometry, organic geometry, knows that that's the worst possible system to house human beings. Well, no, it's not. If you're the guys in the lodge, interested in controlling human beings and taking away their power, no, it's not the worst, it's the best.
Mm-hmm.
It all depends, again, what side you're coming from. Everything in society is best if you're wanting to control human. My Jesus, you look at the window, you couldn't believe what a perfect system for control. exists out there. It's almost perfect. Because another thing, it gives you the illusion that you're free, the illusion that you know, you're better off. And of course, they only need to pump a lot of horror stories about Africa or the Far East, which is artificially suppressed, by the way, by the World Bank and the Bank of International Settlements and all of that stuff. So those places are artificially degraded in the first instance. But then, of course, it makes great press to keep showing you all their poverty and all their horror so that American system goes, well, we've got to be glad for what we have. Better salute the flag and stay good. You know, and
exactly.
Even if our few liberties slip away and we don't quite have as much that we should have, well, you know, it's worse everywhere else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So bit by bit, America has lost its original, you know, constitutional framework and more importantly, the moral framework upon which any document is based. Because constitution may be one thing, but, you know, it's still a piece of paper. If you don't have the virtue behind agreements, the piece of paper is worthless. And I'm not saying that because I'm anti-constitutional. I'm saying that because I'm a philosopher who understands that any document, any social contract is worthless if the physical and psychic and psychological, you see, bonds between man have eroded. Then you can wave that document all you like. You can bullhorn the Constitution till you're blue in the face. It's not going to matter because the human being has lost his constitutional sovereignty within his own psyche. He's no longer a spiritually sound individual. In fact, he's no longer even sane. He's insane. So what good is it telling me that the Constitution is, we got to get back to the Constitution and honor that document? Yeah, we do. But we first need to get to the step where people have got their sanity back again. And then not the semi-depraved, insane, undereducated, lost, neurotic, stressed out, medicated, you know, tranquilized, regimented creatures that they're fast becoming.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Constitution is within, you know, yourself and your bonds and your relationships to each individual. You know, where trust between two people exists anymore.
Mm.
You tell me trust is existing today, you know, a cop comes to your... pulls your car, he's got his hand on his gun half the time before he even said, hello, sir.
That's right.
Today, on a phone call, you got to, you know, you're in a bank transaction. Just to even open an account or do the slightest social thing today, you're treated as a felon. Mm-hmm. If you don't provide the identification when you're giving your credit card to go into a movie, now get me, you're paying them. I mean, I would have imagined they want your money, so you're paying them. But no. You have to show that you are not some fraudulent person. You don't have to pay them for the service. Can you imagine? And people have accepted that. And should you stand in a queue and make a problem with that? It's not just the clerks that draw a bad face. The rest of the queue condemns you for holding them up.
Well, no, it's even more than that. It's the people themselves in the position are, you know, fumbling and are like, oh, I better do it, you know, as soon as you say it. Oh, I'll
get
it out right away.
Yeah.
You know?
That's right. But the whole energy, see, I've had this happen, you can't imagine how many times that has happened because I'm a person in society that does do this. I do, you know, not let them just index me, stamp me, file me, you know, and push me around. I will say, hey, I'm paying you, you don't ask me for identification. Where does it say here in Perspex that I'm meant to give you? Show me the bylaw or the law that says, produce it right now for me, you know, that tells me that I need to buy this cup of coffee, this stupid Starbucks chain, and I got to show you ID because I presented you with a credit card. That my money's not good enough and I'm presumed a felon. You can't even get halfway through that sentence before the whole place is now turned on you as some sort of crank. Like, you're the dinosaur, you're the anachronism. Show the ID, man, you know, get out your card and just make life easy. It's not just the clerks, what I can understand, they get a bit, you know, uneasy. But what has amazed me is that everybody else turns around and goes, hey, what's your problem?
Yeah.
Jesus, see, when in Ireland, it don't work like that. When I grew up and you're confronting authority figures, maybe they're at the welfare, the dole, or wherever they happen to be, you know, you'd never have heard that. That's why that country fought back hard, because everybody would have chimed in on your behalf. And then you want to see these guys, these clerks, jump through hoops when your cause is now taken by everybody standing in the crowd, both old and young, from people of 18 years to 80, going, yeah, that's right, we're behind him, you know, yeah, get on with that. Then you see establishment move when there's a strong chorus of people who suddenly leave their own, you know, personal agendas aside to make sure that we understand how the pecking order works here. Well, that's gone completely.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when you see a climate like that, expect trouble. Expect trouble.
Yeah.
I don't know if that trouble will be, as, you know, others are saying, concentration camps, you know, military in the streets. It doesn't really matter, you see. Those are all just symptoms. What I'm more, you know, have a problem with is the cause of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
The people in the Far East are in chains of iron because the banks have destroyed their countries. But in the West, we're in chains of gold. But a chain is a chain, be it in gold or be it in iron.
It's true enough. True enough, and be constantly being asked for your papers.
Yeah, what does it matter if you're being taken to your death, to the guillotine, but they're taking the scenic route? Whereas everybody else, you know, takes, you know, they go by, you know, a tunnel. Well, does it really matter at the end of the day if you're you know, going to have your head chopped off, but they go, don't worry about it, you'll enjoy the trip, it's lovely.
Mm.
But America has settled for that. It almost foresees its own doom. Because I can't imagine how things can get so bad that you can't see it with your own two eyes. The situation in the schools is so alarming, the educational level, that alone should have caused a worldwide, you know, a nationwide revolution. The illegal immigration alone should have caused a national revolution in that country. The presence of the Federal Reserve, I mean, you can go on. I can go on a list from now to next week of the things that, you know, people in America should be just absolutely screaming about. But you barely, CAFTA, NAFTA, shall we go on, you know?
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. The blinking last presidential election is enough. Granted, that did get some attention. But there's plenty of other injustices. Because you wouldn't know it if you went around the streets and saw the apathy of people. And as I said, then when you stand up as some kind of, you know, teacher or somebody who, you know, you only meet a very few people like yourself in this world who, are, you know, get it and go, yeah, I agree exactly with the same thing as you. I can't, you know, focus on anything else because this is abominable what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked out that it's not just a matter of, okay, we need to get, you know, Heckle out and Jekyll in, and then everything will be fine. No, we've worked out that it's a one-party system, and that the political pigsty is not going to work. And now I know to pick up on my own time and start listening to certain radio shows and get on the Internet and pick up some books that, you know, maybe my whole family will think I'm a nut. And now I'm really going to be an outsider. But I'm going to do it because I know that the truth has not been given to me, and I refuse to be, you know, in that position. I will educate and teach myself, no matter what the cost and what the time. That is, those are the people who will create the real change. So you should never be pessimistic about it.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you see that, you know, other brothers and sisters are fast asleep.
Yeah, I agree. And Michael, thank you so much for, you know, these words of wisdom.